things cost no less than paradise. So, do not sell them except for paradise. Imam Hussein's warnings awakened few men of the enemy's hordes. One of them was Hur, son of Yazid Riyahi. He was one of the commanders of Yazid's troops. He repented and fought for Imam Hussein till he sacrificed his life for the Imam and his lofty values. On the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, after sealing the arguments for the hordes of Yazid, decided to fight against the illegitimate and corrupt Umayyad regime. This free-spirited and kind-hearted leader invited the enemy to God and freedom till his last breath. When he had sustained countless injuries and had no power to stand, he saw that the unmanly enemies were heading toward the tents. Therefore, he stood on his knees and cried out, "If you have no religion, at least be free-spirited in your world." He meant that even if they do not believe in God and his messenger, at least they should adhere to the tradition of their forefathers, who would not seize the properties of the enemy before defeating him. As a matter of fact, this had been the tradition of Arabs since old times, and the Imam was reminding of their traditions. Imam Hussein was reminding them of not assaulting the women and properties while he was alive. Imam Hussein stood against the corrupt Umayyad regime and didn't capitulate to the godless tyrant Yazid. That's why he has become famous as the Lord of the Free. He preferred freedom of spirit to life under oppression and humility.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Hussein's Mubahala, sacrificing his dearest ones to rise up on the path of God. August 30th, 2020. This is a short part of a Dars-e-Kharij-e Fiqh lecture delivered on the eve of Muharram on March 12th, 2002. Many people from among the respected elders, the narrators of hadith, prominent figures, respected people, wise men, caring and somewhat caring individuals, kept coming to Imam Hussein and saying, "Sir, in doing this, you are engaging in a useless action, hurting yourself and the household of the Prophet, and humiliating the people of truth. They were saying such things. From the beginning, when Imam Hussein was planning on leaving Makkah, and some people found out about this, these various ethical obstacles began to emerge in front of Imam Hussein. This continued up until the night before Ashura. It is very difficult to have patience in the face of such events. In the same speech that I mentioned, I said that Imam Khomeini, may God be pleased with him, waited in the same way, and his patience was similar.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum.
أنا لاتشان.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance. September
27th, 2017.
أنا لاتشان.
There were many who told Imam Khomeini, "Sir, we are losing these young people. They are being killed in this way. The country is being ruined." During the revolutionary movement, some were telling him that he was causing the best young people to get killed. Being patient in the face of these clumsy sympathies is a great task, a very great task. It requires much strength. He waited. Patience is not just in the face of physical pressures and sufferings. Look at these pressures that are brought in the form of prudence and caution, where some say, "Sir, you are acting imprudently." To be patient in the face of these and not give up the path that is clear, which leads to growth. This is the great and beautiful patience that Imam Hussein had. And then his companions are killed one by one in that horrible situation.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
The abduction of indigenous children was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. This is perhaps why the Israeli regime military targets children. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Benny Bland Ryder. This article is published under the heading, From Boarding Schools to Child Detention, Lives of Children Matter. Stay tuned for the details. Yes, I am thinking of Palestinian children and undocumented children as well, mused Dean activist Melissa Tesso. They are literally being killed daily by these settler governments. As an essential part of her culture, running helps to process things. And so she did the 2.15 run in memory of 215 indigenous children who were found in a mass grave at Kamloops Residential School in Canada. On May 29, 2021, Al Jazeera reported that the remains of more than 200 indigenous children, some as young as 3, have been found at the site of a former residential school in western province of British Columbia. To our knowledge, these missing children are undocumented deaf. Tekalumpus Toskumpe First Nation Chief Rosanne Casimir explained, "They are among the many victims of mental and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence over a period of 100 years during which church-supported boarding schools operated across Canada. By forcibly taking children from their families, the schools sought to break Indigenous family and cultural ties in order to assimilate children into white Canadian society." According to Muscovitz Voices, co-founder of Bear Clan Patrol, Calgary, and chairman of MIM, Social Justice Committee, approximately 6,000 Native children died in residential schools from disease, beatings, firing squads, malnutrition, and electrocution, among other forms of torture and neglect. The residential schools took the children from the land, Voices continues, adding, to disconnect people from their culture in order to take the land from children. Moreover, this form of genocide, he says, is ongoing as children are still removed from their ancestral lineages. One of the worst and most powerful things on this earth is the look in a mother's eyes and the pain she experiences when she has that which she loves most in this world taken away from her. Because the violence is ongoing, so is the trauma. Mental scars that are generational in nature, in that they are passed down from parents to children in a never-ending cycle of pain. Nevertheless, what happened to the children at Kamloops Residential School, writes Adel Skander, assistant professor of global communication at Simon Fraser University, is neither unique nor surprising. Like settler colonial projects everywhere, including the Americas and Palestine, its objectives, he continues, were always a combination of land appropriation, resource extraction, and demographic engineering. The abduction of indigenous children, he concludes, was a project meant to render the worlds unsalvageable, create new realities underground, demoralize them out of resistance. Given this framework, it makes sense that the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestinian children would be much the same. Indeed, in the past few days, the Zionist regime has launched a massive arrest campaign against Palestinians who participated in recent uprisings against the colonial project. As Abir Kopti notes, Zionist regime police officers, border police, and secret service members are expected to arrest approximately 500 participants in peaceful protests. Among those arrested have been children, including Abdul Khaler and Mohammad Bournat, sons of Berlin activists by Ayad Bournat. In an interview with Robert Inlakish, Bournat chronicles the history of Israeli regime aggression that has for years been unleashed on his family. Earlier in May, Zionist forces murdered his nephew Islam, a 16-year-old boy who was participating in the protest. Since then, they have repeatedly invaded his house, along with other homes, wreaking havoc and arresting the children of other families. After they took Abdul Khalik and Muhammad, my wife and my daughter don't sleep. The tears haven't left my wife's eye, said Iyad. My youngest son, Muhyiddin, he continues, Abdul Khalik and Muhammad are now in Al-Mukbiya prison, a detention facility in West Al-Quds that, in Lakish says, has a reputation for using high-level forms of torture during interrogations. Indeed, Bernard reports that his lawyer, who communicated with Abdul Khalik via computer screen, attests that the boy says he is being placed in what is known as a ghost chair for more than 15 hours a day in order to extract information that he does not have. According to Bernard, the ghost chair is small so that the hands and feet can be tightly tied to inflict a maximum amount of pain. These two boys are among the many children now in the Zionist regime jails. Palestinian journalist Zaina Halwani, recently arrested while covering protests in Sheikh Jarrah, documented her experience listening to Palestinian children screaming for their mothers during few nights that she spent in prison. In 1948, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion warned, "We must do everything to ensure Palestinians never do return." Indeed, he hoped that the old will die and the young will forget, ensuring that they would not return to their homes. This is perhaps why the Zionist regime military targets children like Abdul Khalik and Muhammad. They want to begin breaking the resistance of the Palestinians when they are young, in hopes that they will leave their land. It was also the rationale behind forcibly taking indigenous children away from their family in order to send them to the now infamous boarding schools, thereby severing their connection with the land. Fortunately, for the indigenous in the Americas and in Palestine, that strategy has failed. This resistance demonstrates the spiritual relationship between indigenous peoples and their land, a connection that native people believe the pipeline will sever. Given both these examples, it is clear that colonial efforts to ethnically clear the land has completely failed. As Melissa Tasso concludes, it shouldn't take the findings of our people's remains to validate this horrible legacy of colonial regimes. Respect our humanity by respecting the results, the truth in history, and by supporting our struggle for liberation. Stop treating us the same way our kids got mistreated in residential and boarding. Stand up for indigenous rights always. The same should be said for Palestinian children too. The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Taliban are pressing ahead with their offensive across Afghanistan, capturing Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province, in the south, as they've taken half of the country's 34 provincial capitals in recent days. The second and third largest cities, Herat and Kandahar, were also captured on Thursday. More than two-thirds of the country is now under the control of the militants, who are tightening the noose around the capital, Kabul. UN agencies have warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. amid the violence that has escalated the suffering of millions in the war-torn countries. Thousands are fleeing from the capital, fleeing from areas to the capital, Kabul, in search of shelter. Our correspondent, Amin Alami, is joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin, talk to us about the significance of the recent Taliban gains, and also the UN has mentioned that a humanitarian catastrophe is on the rise.
Well, Bhatia, the Taliban are advancing rapidly all over Afghanistan. They have captured several provincial capitals over the past 24 hours. For instance, they are currently controlling 18 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan. But the fact on the ground proves that the recent provinces were fallen into the hands of Taliban without any strong resistance by Afghan security forces. In some cases, local officials have handed over some provincial capitals to the Taliban, mainly in southern part of this country and northern areas. Ghazni city, the capital of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan, was handed over to Taliban by Dawood Laghwani, the governor of this province. Later on the day, when he was heading to the capital Kabul via Kabul-Herat highway, he was arrested by Afghan security forces in Maidan Shah, the capital of Maidan Wardak province in central, very close to Kabul. In the meantime, the Taliban also captured the capital of Logar province, that is the city of Puli Alam. However, the intense fightings are also underway in most areas of Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan, as well as in Laghman and Nangarhar provinces, again in eastern Afghanistan. This comes as some top political leaders in Afghanistan, especially in northern part of this country, are still insisting on resisting against the Taliban militant group. For instance, Atta Mohammed Nur, the prominent political leader in northern Afghanistan, as well as the Marshal Abdurrashid Dostum, recently declared their commitment to strongly resist against the Taliban militants in case they continue to further launch attacks on the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital of northern Balkh province. Marshal Dostum named this strategic province in northern Afghanistan, in Balkh province, as the entrance gate of Afghanistan. And he said that under the strong support receiving from locals, we will successfully defeat the Taliban not only in Balkh province but also across the entire northern Afghanistan and then across the all provinces of Afghanistan. This comes as top U.S. officials has also asked President Ghani to resign. The demand has so far been not rejected or confirmed by the Afghan presidential here in Kabul so far.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin, Press TV's Amin Alami joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have our guest, senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, who's joining us from New York. And research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, who's with us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ian Williams in New York. Mr. Williams, what do you make of this offensive? Why did everything unravel so fast for the Afghan government? All right, unfortunately, we're experiencing some technical difficulties with Mr. Williams in New York. Mr. Williams, stay with us as we get that sorted out. I'm going to address that same question to Mr. Samueli in Budapest. Mr. Samueli, what do you make of the Taliban offensive, the recent gains that they've made so rapidly? Why did everything unravel so fast for the Afghan government?
Well, I think it's unraveled very fast because of complete demoralization and incompetence on the part of the Afghan government. I mean, there are two separate issues here, which is the situation for the United States, and then there's a situation for the Taliban. So without question, this has been a profound humiliation for the United States. I mean, they've been fighting against the Taliban for 20 years, and then they announce that they're going to withdraw, and the whole crisis that they've created over 20 years just seems to collapse really within a matter of days. So that is without question, a debacle. The other question, I think, is that will the Taliban ultimately prevail? And that I think, is far from certain. I mean, if we looked at Afghan history, I mean, there's always a pattern whereby somebody is on the offensive, it seems that the opposition melts away, then the victorious army marches into Kabul, takes over, and then the opposition just regroups in the countryside, in the mountains, and then it in turn starts resisting against the ruling group. So we had this, remember, back to the Soviets who took over Kabul in the late 1970s, and look where that got them. They immediately were facing enormous resistance in the countryside. Then eventually the pro-Soviet government collapsed, and then we had a civil war between the various Mujahideen factions that fought it out during the early 90s. The Taliban was triumphant in 1996, but they in turn were facing resistance from the Northern Alliance. And you remember in 2001, the Taliban melted away as pathetically as the Afghan government is melting away. And they, of course, in turn then regrouped and mounted their own offensive. So this is a pattern in Afghanistan. It is a very difficult, complicated, diverse country to rule over. I mean, it's not hard to even describe it as a country. I mean, it's a warlords, it's regions, it's religious differences, ethnic differences. You've got Uzbeks, Tajiks, Pashtuns. Very hard to rule it over. So I don't expect the Taliban to have a particularly easy time of ruling. And if they continue in this way, ignoring the entreaties of the international actors such as the United States and Russia and China, and just simply press ahead for victory, sure, they're going to end up in disaster, just like they did in the period of 1996 to 2001, when they were diplomatically isolated. No one recognized them other than Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Pakistan, and thus they were very vulnerable to attack to the United States, and no one said boo when the Americans invaded.
Back to New York now, Mr. Williams. What does the current situation say about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, about the $1 trillion spent, all the claims of propping up and equipping security forces in Afghanistan? Why aren't the security forces having any success against the Taliban right now?
As lots of people have pointed out, it's Vietnam all over again. The rosy reports from politically inspired generals to meet the politicians' demands in Washington to show that the taxpayers' money and the conscripts, the soldiers' lives were not being wasted. So the reports came out, they were completely Panglossian. And remember, this is all of their own making. This is blowback to the maximum. They originally set up the Taliban with the help of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and the others to fight the Soviets. So it was blowback. They came back and bit them. And the same thing is still happening now. Remember, it's a U.S. ally funded, with the military funded and trained by the U.S., Pakistan, which has been covertly helping the Taliban all of this time. It's a very murky situation in which nobody really seems to care about the Afghan people, which the Afghan people have noticed. They knew that the U.S. wasn't propping up the fight against the Taliban to protect them or to protect women's rights. It was in their geopolitical interest to do so, and it was in the interest of politicians back in Washington to pretend that they were fighting the good fight. So I agree that from now on, I think the Taliban have got some hard going, because they're hitting up against the rock. Dostum, the Uzbeks, the people in the north, the old Northern Alliance, they're ever heavily armed, loaded for bear. They've got no time for the Taliban, and they will fight back. And just all around the country, it's a heavily armed country. Everybody is heavily armed. The Taliban have shown no sign of catering to popular opinion. And not just where they're alienating women, intellectuals, lots of other people. They're going to be every bit as arrogant as the Americans, with the only distinction that they look like the locals, and like the, which the Americans never managed to do, even when they wore the strange Afghan hats. So it's a mess of America's making. They came into Afghanistan allegedly with a UN backing, we should remember, because of the 9/11 incident. But immediately that was hijacked by those politicians in Washington and diverted into a crusade against Iraq, rightly or wrongly, most of us think. But they went into Iraq. That's where they put all their forces, and they left Afghanistan on the back burner. They didn't pursue the victory, the military victory that they'd had. They didn't really pursue the nation building. They made it very plain. They treated the local politicians with disdain.
Right.
I mean, just think, over a year or so ago, they started negotiations with the Taliban without even telling the politicians in Kabul. How is that for showing your disdain and contempt? How do you expect Afghans to go and fight for die and to fight and die in a war where the Americans are going to sign off on it without telling them what's happening?
Okay, let's cross over to Mr. Samuel Lee. Mr. Williams brought up an interesting point. That's the negotiations that started around last year in Doha. Those negotiations, I believe, are still taking place there. What relevance do they have now at this point? What are the objectives and goals of such talks at a time when the country is being overrun by the Taliban?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, of course, they should be of relevance because if the Taliban doesn't want to end up as disastrously as they ended up during from 1996 to 2001, then they should engage in some kind of negotiations under international auspices to set up a coalition government, a multi-party government, you know, of all the four factions in Afghanistan, and try to rule as part of a coalition. If, as is likely, the Taliban isn't going to do it, if it is likely that they're just going to press ahead for victory, then I think they're heading for disaster, because it's already clear that its neighbors, the Central Asian countries, are very much now already aligning themselves with Russia. They're engaging in military preparations. Should there be any trouble coming from the Afghanistan, I think the Chinese are very wary that a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan will become another fount of Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, the Chinese are already very wary of their Muslim population in Xinjiang, and concerned, you know, what the impact of the Taliban would be then. So if they just press ahead for victory, I think they're going to find themselves isolated and probably subject to all manner of subversion from its neighbors, who have every incentive of making life as difficult as possible for the Taliban. So they'll be sponsoring Northern Alliance and various indigenous insurgencies against the Taliban. So, if they're intelligent, then they would take these Doha talks seriously. I suspect they're not, and they're going to head for the same disaster they ended up in 2001.
Ian Williams, will a Taliban rule Afghanistan in 2021? Will it resemble the previous time that they were in power in the 90s? What will basically Afghan life be like in the areas under Taliban rule?
I suspect it's going to be horrifying for women, for anybody who's independent minded. These people don't want to be in a coalition. They could have been in a coalition any time. They could have been part of a coalition government. They've been offered that for the last 10 years or more. No problem. They don't want a coalition. They're getting their orders from God, and they're not going to take them from anybody else. They're not going to accept mediation. So they're going to carry on behaving frightfully. All the signs are, wherever they've gone in, they've engaged in retaliatory shootings and executions. They're going to carry on with the same ideological, theological agenda, and they're going to alienate the people. And this time, of course, they're weakened because the infidel are out of the equation. The one claim to legitimacy that they had was that the infidel US was on the Afghan territory, on Muslim territory. That's no longer the case. They've removed their own sort of best ideological ally in that sense. From now on, it's going to be them versus the co-religionists and their co-nationalists and the neighbors as well, you know, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, they're all there, they're, you know, nominally Muslim, and they are not going to tolerate any incursions from across the border, and the Taliban will almost certainly do that, and then they'll get whacked.
George Samueli, what will the Taliban run Afghanistan mean for the presence of groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh? Of course, we have to mention the Haqqani Network, which was an Al-Qaeda affiliate that has fought shoulder to shoulder with the Taliban.
Yes, well, that's the one commitment that they made when the Trump administration signed their original Doha agreement, which was that they would not allow Afghanistan to once again become a center for Al-Qaeda, for any international terrorist group. I don't take that very seriously. I mean, they've adhered to it so far that Al-Qaeda hasn't yet returned. It's quite likely that, Al-Qaeda, various Islamic fundamentalist groups will return. And again, if that happens, then the Taliban will be very vulnerable to its neighbors. So you've got, Iran, you've got Russia, you've got China, you've got the Central Asians, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, all of whom are very, very anxious about Afghanistan becoming once again a center of Islamic fundamentalism. And this is a long-standing concern of its neighbors. And the Taliban has done very little to reassure its neighbors that it has learned its lessons and it will never again become the center of international terrorism. So I do think that it is quite likely that all of the Al-Qaeda types are going to be back, and disaster beckons for Afghanistan, sadly.
Ian Williams, what about Pakistan, a main variable in Afghanistan's Taliban saga? Where do you see Pakistan in this equation?
Well, it's not just Pakistan, it's also Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. The U.S. has never dealt with them. The U.S. has still not dealt with the Saudi role in the original 9/11. It closed its eyes for geopolitical reasons. It closed its eyes all these years to Pakistan. I mean, there was Pakistan hosting the leader of Al-Qaeda in one of its big garrison towns, and nobody knew. Well, there might be non-halal, but pigs were flying all the way through Pakistan when that was happening, and they took no notice whatsoever, and the US took no notice because they were playing Pakistan for other geopolitical reasons. They have never had a connected, joined up foreign policy in Washington. They've appeased Pakistan when it suited. They appeased Saudi Arabia. Do you think those elements in Saudi Arabia really love the Americans and the Israelis? They're waiting there for their time to come back for more. And they will provide the resources for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and whoever. And the U.S. hasn't done anything about the source, so it can't complain when it flows down onto them. And it really is a mess of Washington's own making almost all the way through, which is bad. It'd be good to have what the Germans call Schadenfreude, joy at other people's discomfort, but the Afghan people are going to suffer from this. They are suffering from it. And they suffer just as they suffered when the U.S. originally got the Taliban in there. This was on the way to becoming a sort of fairly progressive secular democracy up to a point. Women engineers, women pilots, etc., etc., all cast back to the Middle Ages with U.S. support and the arming. That was the situation when blowback was on. That was the situation that set it for the blowback of Al-Qaeda and 9/11. Now it's deja vu all over again, as the famous American philosopher said.
And very briefly, if you may, Mr. Samueli, give us your thoughts on where Pakistan falls into all of this.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that Pakistan has been playing a very two-faced game in all of this. It's pretended to be supporting the United States' global war on terror, whereas, of course, all along it has seen the Taliban as its instrument. It was a mechanism for the Pakistan to dominate Afghanistan. And as your other guest pointed out, the fact was that Bin Laden, and it was to get Bin Laden that the United States invaded Afghanistan. Bin Laden made his home in Pakistan. I mean, it's ridiculous to try to argue that the Pakistanis did not know that Bin Laden was peacefully living in its country. So they knew he was living there, and they left him alone. They, you know, let him go on living there in comfort. They never notified the United States he is here. And in fact, the Pakistanis were very indignant about the U.S. raid that actually eventually killed Bin Laden. Hey, you know, our sovereignty has been violated. So yeah, I mean, Pakistan has been playing a two-faced game. The United States has known that it's playing a two-faced game, just as the United States has known for decades that Saudi Arabia plays a two-faced game, pretending to be a supporter of the global war on terror while actually financing these terrorist groups all over the world.
Well, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thank you, gentlemen. Senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, joining us from New York. Also, thanks to Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. And also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The United States is now seeking to minimize or dismiss expert medical evidence provided by neuropsychiatrist Michael Koppelman, who last year testified that WikiLeaks whistleblower Julian Assange is autistic, suffers from recurring depression, and was likely to try to kill himself if extradited to the United States. We now present you an article written by Brett Wilkins, staff writer for Common Dreams website. Based in San Francisco, his work covers issues of social justice, human rights, and war and peace. The article is titled, Further Blow to Press Freedoms as U.S. Wins Appeal in Effort to Extradite Julian Assange. Britain's High Court on Wednesday, 11th of August, handed the United States a win in its bid to extradite Julian Assange. Press freedom and other human rights defenders renewed calls for the Biden administration to drop all charges against the WikiLeaks founder. Lord Justice Tim Holroyd on Wednesday, 11th of August, ruled that the U.S. government may expand its appeal for a lower court's rejection of the Trump administration's attempt to extradite Julian Assange. On 4th of January, Judge Vanessa Braitzer of the Westminster Magistrates Court warned that extradition would be oppressive by reasons of Assange's mental health, and that there was a substantial risk the WikiLeaks whistleblower would kill himself in a U.S. prison. Claire Dobbin, an attorney representing the U.S. government in the case, had countered that Julian Assange would be able to resist suicide in American custody. The United States is now seeking to minimize or dismiss expert medical evidence provided by the neuropsychiatrist Michael Koppelman, who last year testified that Julian Assange is autistic, suffers from recurring depression, and was likely to try to kill himself if extradited to the United States. Lord Justice Tim Holroyd said Wednesday that the High Court would hear the full appeal on 27th and 28th of October this year. Julian Assange has been imprisoned in London's notorious Belmarsh prison for over 2 years now. Speaking outside the Royal Courts of Justice in London on Wednesday, 11th of August, the former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn told demonstrators that journalism is a very dangerous and risky profession when done properly, and that Julian Assange walks in the great tradition of great fearless journalists. Jeremy Corbyn added, "We're here to support Julian Assange and demand his freedom. Julian Assange, to me, walks in the great tradition of great fearless journalists. We're here to support Julian Assange and demand his freedom, and will be here as many times as it takes to continue making that call." Stella Morris, Julian Assange's wife, told protesters that the US government is exploiting the inherently unfair extradition arrangements with this country in order to arbitrarily prolong his imprisonment. Amnesty International legal advisor Simon Crowther said outside of the courtroom that charges like those against Julian Assange should never be brought against journalists or publishers. Simon Crowther said, "What this allows the US to do is to challenge journalists and editors when they publish things the US does not want in the public domain, sometimes classified material, which is the lifeblood of investigative journalists when they're investigating things like war crimes and crimes against humanity that are perpetrated by states like the United States." Simon Crowther noted that this would have a very significant chilling effect if the US were to win this case. Journalists would have to look over their shoulder and worry about their legal liability when they accept information from sources provided to them confidentially. Meanwhile, Amnesty International, in a tweet on Wednesday, 11th of August, wrote, "Simon Crowther, Amnesty International's legal advisor, explains why the Julian Assange case matters so much for freedom of expression and human rights, and why Amnesty International are calling on the American and the British governments to drop the charges against Julian Assange." Amnesty International, on Wednesday, 11th of August, joined Assange Defense, Freedom of the Press Foundation, the International Federation of Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, and other advocacy groups that reiterated earlier calls for U.S. authorities to drop all charges against the jailed whistleblower. Niels Muisnieks, Amnesty's European director, said in a statement, "This attempt by the U.S. government to get the court to reverse its decision not to allow Julian Assange's extradition on the basis of new diplomatic assurances is a blatant legal sleight of hand." Niels Muisnieks continued, This disingenuous appeal should be dismissed by the court, and President Biden should take the opportunity to drop these politically motivated charges, which have put media freedom and freedom of expression in the dark. Niels Musnick, Amnesty International's European director, added, President Barack Obama opened the investigation into Julian Assange. President Donald Trump brought charges against him. It is now time for President Biden to do the right thing and help end this farcical prosecution, which should never have been brought in the first place. Edward Snowden, a former computer intelligence consultant who leaked highly classified information from the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, in 2013 when he was an employee and subcontractor for the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, on 10th of August said, the world's foremost human rights organization, Amnesty International, has issued an extremely strong statement denouncing the Biden administration's political persecution of Julian Assange, which reignites tomorrow. Julian Assange is charged in the United States with violating the 1917 Espionage Act and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for publishing classified U.S. military documents on WikiLeaks over a decade ago. Among the materials brought to light by Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are the so-called collateral murder video, which shows a U.S. Army helicopter crew killing a group of innocent Iraqi civilians. The Afghan War Diary and the Iraq War Logs, all of which reveal U.S. and allied war crimes in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Many of the documents published by WikiLeaks were provided by former U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Unlike Manning, who spent 7 years in prison before her sentence was commuted by Barack Obama in January of 2017, none of the soldiers or commanders implicated in war crimes by WikiLeaks was seriously punished. Julian Assange could spend the rest of his life behind bars if he is convicted of all the charges against him.